So I want to press into the parable this morning. And we have, those of you who've been here for a little few weeks, we've been in chapter 15 of Luke, the parable of the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost son. We've seen that that's the heart of God, to bring people into his household, to be their father, to make them part of his family. We've seen Jesus launch into chapter 16, a parable where he challenges his disciples to leverage all that they are and all that they have for the kingdom. And so we're going to finish up chapter 16 this morning. And, wow, they can hear me across the street. And, we're going to finish up chapter 16 with the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. I know you just hear that and you go, rich man and Lazarus. Oh, not another one of those sermons. Well, hang in there, okay? And so, two main characters in this parable, right? There's the rich man. He's like a high-end kind of guy. He's high-end in the clothes he wears. He probably belongs to the 1%. He's high-end in his diet. Everything on his table every day is just over-the-top yummy. And then there's Lazarus, the poor guy. And Lazarus, he has no clothing but rags, no food but scraps, and that's on a good day. And he has no company but dogs. So quite the contrast, right? The rich guy and the Lazarus. And here's an amazing thing that I don't know if I ever knew or if I did it, I had forgotten. In this is the only character in all the parables of Jesus who has a name. The poor man Lazarus. Jesus taught a few parables. This is the only character that was given a name. And names are pretty important to God. I mean, if you go back to the prophet Isaiah, these are the kinds of things that God says about name. He says to the people of Israel and to every individual person of the tribe of Israel, he says, I have called you by name. And then he takes it a step further, in my opinion. He says, I have written your name on the palm of my hand. That's the God. And God so loves us, so is endeared to us by our names in some ways that when he chooses to identify himself as the God of the first covenant, he calls himself this. I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Those three individuals who are part of this greater story, I use their names to describe who I am. That says something about the love God has for all of us by name. Lazarus. Now, can I just kind of start to bring up what I think are a few of the punchlines of the parable? Because I know that you want to jump right to the chasm and the fire and the water and the hand. Just put that aside. Just let it go, okay? So I want to grab a couple of things that I think are true to the heart of this parable. One is, I think Jesus describes in the most simple of ways, but very profound, what are the marks of a disciple? What are the marks of somebody who followed Jesus? And I think he gives us two marks here. The first mark is, it's someone who listens to the law and prophets, which if you listen long enough to the gospel stories, you discover when Jesus says you should listen to the law and prophets, it's because they point to me. So a follower is somebody who listens to Jesus. Everything the law and prophets said pointed to him. He's now the reality fulfilling all of that. And so the mark of a disciple is a person who listens to Jesus. Do you remember that kind of supernatural over-the-top story called the Transfiguration? Where Jesus takes like three of his closest disciples, they go to the top of this mountain and they start praying. And all of a sudden they experience that, how to describe it, the uncreated light of God. Whatever that just kind of just fills Jesus, flows out of Jesus. He's just transfigured in this light. And alongside him are Moses and Elijah, the law and the prophets. So there you have Jesus like glowing, I mean like the sun. You have Moses and Elijah. And then it says that God the Father shows up and speaks. And this is what he says. Listen, this is my son, pointing to Jesus. Listen to him. I mean, I think that just sums it up. And so Jesus was not only saying to his disciples and all the religious leaders like the Pharisees standing there on that afternoon when he taught this parable. And I'm pretty sure it's an afternoon. I mean, it just seems that reasonable people are not morning people. But so I just think Jesus was teaching in the afternoon, but I could be wrong about that. He's probably a 24/7 kind of guy. But anyways, I think this is in the afternoon, and he's teaching it. And in this moment, those disciples encountered this most basic thing. If you want to be my followers, you listen to me, and all that God has been doing is pointed to me. And I think that's central, right? But I think there's something that is as equally central that this parable teaches, and that is a disciple or follower of Jesus has compassion for the poor. So at the early service, we do this thing we call the summary of the law, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, body, and down. This is the first great and great commandment, and the second one is like it, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets depend on these two. I think, you know, love God, love your neighbor. That's the deal, man. That's where we live. That's where the traction meets the road, right? This sort of heart devotion and passion for Jesus and for God. And that sort of begins to turn into this passion and devotion and want to help the poor. The real poor, not the abstract poor, not the overly spiritualized poor. I mean the poor, like Lazarus in this parable. I think love God, love neighbor, listen to Jesus, have compassion for the poor. I think that's at the heart of this parable. And we could quit now and just jump to the peace, you know, and get to the donuts. And we would have gotten the heart of this parable. And you can leave all that other stuff in the weeds, as far as I'm concerned. But I never wanted to waste time that was given to me, so I'm going to keep going. Okay? And the other thing that this parable begins to hint at is things like this. I think it's true today, and I think it was true in Jesus' day. Sometimes when we think that we're material blessed and we have resources and you know, we're doing really, really well, we think that's a sign of God that we're really special. That we really have God's special approval and favor. And I just don't think that's true at all. I think it's a sign and evidence of God's blessing. And the thunder of the scriptures is that you are blessed to be a blessing. And so Jesus is saying in this parable, listen, I entrust you. God is saying, listen, I entrust you. I'm gonna, for some of us, it's like, I'm gonna pile stuff into your wallet and your bank account. I'm gonna give you resources, and that's so you can bless others. That's what he's trying to say. And so I think we need to get that, right? And he was speaking this to the Pharisees, and between last week's parable and this parable, there's verse 14, and if you were a Pharisee and you ever read the Gospel of Luke, this would have really ticked you off. Because it says in verse 14, and the Pharisees who were lovers of money, which means that they were just people in their lives out of balance, that somehow love of money, love of comfort and convenience and wealth and resources and privilege had just begun to fill up their heart more than love for God. And so Jesus is speaking this to them, and he's saying, well, some of you will remember this in the 60s, and some of you will know it because you've been told about it and seen reruns. And so in the 60s, there was this show called Lost in Space. And it was the story of the Robinson family that was sent on a spaceship to be the first human family to visit Alpha Centauri. And so it's the story. And on the spaceship is a robot. And his name is Robot. And he's not Robbie or the Robot. That's another sci-fi movie. You got it wrong if you think that. This will help you out on Jeopardy. But his name was Robot. And the Robot and the youngest member of the family, Will, Real Robinson, became buddies. And they're always doing adventures together. And the Robot had this practice that anytime anything was threatening, he would do this. Danger, danger, Will Robinson. You remember that? How many remember that, right? I mean, that's in your psyche if you're a child of the 60s, right? Danger, danger, Will Robinson. And there's a way in which Jesus is, before he gives the invitation, he's given a little challenge and danger. He's saying about money and wealth and resources, there's some spiritual danger here if we're not careful. It's what you read in the prophet Isaiah. I know Alfred loves the prophet Isaiah. Prophet Amos will turn your world out upside down. My favorite line from the prophet of Amos, when he calls the women who are eating delicacies and drinking their wine on their rich couches, cows of Bashan. I just think that's so hilarious. I mean, that's like the prophet. Is that the Lord sort of calling them cows? I don't know, but that's really, I just think it's hilarious. But in the prophet Amos, it's very clear. The prophet says this to those who were amassing wealth and resources around themselves so that they became a people whose lifestyle was defined by comfort and convenience and privilege. To the point, but here's the danger. If we don't have God at the center of our lives, material resources and wealth and money can do this. It can begin to insulate our lives. It can begin to dull our spiritual senses. It can begin to harden our hearts. It can begin to just make us blind to the people and the needs around us. So there's a way in which Amos and Jesus are saying, don't let money and wealth and possessions take you to that place. You need to be on the alert that this is what could happen. And he was speaking to the Pharisees, and he speaks today, right? The danger of having resources out of balance in our lives. Maybe we could say that one of the other big ideas in the parable is that the ultimate love, the thing that we are passionate about, and you find out what your passion and love is by what you think about, by what you value, by what you invest time and energy in. Perhaps one of the ways Tim Keller would say is what you are most afraid to lose. The ultimate passion of your heart in this life is the trajectory of your soul into eternity. So you have this parable, and everybody wants to talk about what I would call the weeds. I just want us to hear the thunderous central points invitation of this parable that Jesus is speaking to us. That it's important that whatever our central ultimate passion is, it's leading us, it's setting the trajectory of our life. That if we really want to be an authentic follower of Jesus, it'll be about listening to him and his teachings and his way of life. And it'll be about this teachings and way of life and Jesus bringing forth in us this compassion for the poor, the widows, the orphans, the refugees. And we want to read this parable. We want to think about what happens after this life. That whole chasm, fire, water, hell thing. And I don't think that's the chasm Jesus is really interested in emphasizing in this parable. I think what Jesus is trying to call our attention to is there's a chasm here. Today. In this life. And that's the chasm he's speaking to when he tells this parable. Danger, danger. And then there's invitation. Well, let's talk about the Pharisees, because it's easier to talk about the Pharisees than to talk about ourselves, isn't it? So let's just pick on the Pharisees for a little bit. They were interesting guys and gals. As the Gospels describe them, they're this religious organization that is committed to keeping all the law. I mean, they were like scrupulous. They were like meticulous. They were like had religious OCD about keeping the details of the law, right? And they did pretty much, right? They washed hands and washed pots and pans and didn't do things on the Sabbath, and they did all that stuff. And yet Jesus seems to say they're as lost as everybody was lost in chapter 15. So how can that be? How can that be? If they're the keepers of the law and they're still lost. Well, one of the definitions that Christians carry around in our heads about sin is the breaking of God's commandments and law, right? And that's true. That's a good definition, but maybe it's not broad and deep enough in this way. Let me grab a name out of 20th century and Kierkegaard, who said this: sin, missing the mark, getting lost, involves building your identity on anything but God. And that could mean religious rule keeping. And so in some ways, the Pharisees were odd ducks because they had this zeal for God's law, but it really turned into just moral performance. They constructed their own kind of, we're okay, we must have God's approval because we live this way. They really became their own little saviors. And Jesus repeatedly engages them and says, what I can see in your lives, what I can measure in your lives is that you're not building your life on God. My invitation is that you would trade in moral performance for a life that builds itself on God, where there's a true love and devotion and passion in a living relationship with God, which will be through me. Build your life on me, he was saying to them. Love God and love your neighbor. All the others, there's something like 617 laws in the Mosaic Covenant. He says, like, put all those aside and you just do two things. Love God and love neighbor. But they were lost. And they got lost with their stuff. When Jesus says in Matthew, come to me all you who are tired and heavy laden, he's not just talking to the people who at the end of the day are just wasted. He's talking to the people who have not discovered that you don't have to build your own life, construct your own meaning, put yourself together, make it all okay, keep it all running, spin all the plates, all that stuff that we do. And often the sad thing is we do all that in the name of God while really not drinking from the well of God's love. And Jesus is saying, you know, there's this kind of life. If you'll begin to hang out with me, to listen to my words, to do what I ask you to do, if you'll begin to live life with me, there's a kind of life that you'll discover that life is actually a gift to be received, not a project to be constructed. It's a life to be received. It's a life that can be celebrated. It's a life that brings you freedom, not a project. It's a life that changes you from the inside out, rather than living a life of images and scaffolding, which is what we can be so good about. But this inner life that comes out of walking and living with God. Well, let's go back to Lazarus' name. Do you know what Lazarus' name means? The Lord is my help. That's a good name. The Lord is my help. Or God is my helper. But here's the most amazing thing. This character, this poor guy who gets the only name in any parable, I think it's for a reason, right? The Lord is my help. And yet what Jesus seems to be calling forth is not that Lazarus sit there and wait for some divine machine that God sends down and delivers some miraculous plate of food and wardrobe. It seems like the parable Jesus is saying, you know what? What happens in my kingdom is that my followers become the answer to that name. That we become the Lord's co-helpers. That we actually become the hands and feet of Jesus. That we actually become the instruments of help in God's hands. And so God's whole design is that neighbor loves neighbor. And as a friend told me this week, there's a rabbinical comment about this chasm in life, and that you can reach across it with a hand. The chasm is bridged by a hand, a reaching, a stepping, a coming together. And so we send a team of six yesterday to Eastern Kentucky, and they spend the day with the woman mucking out her house and tearing up the floor. They've stepped across the chasm. They've extended a hand. And they gave of their time and their energy and resources. And I think in this parable, we want to get lost in the weeds of... The only thing I think it answers in, about eternity is that what's the trajectory of your soul? Is it with God in this world, being where God is at work, stepping across and bridging the chasms between all peoples? Is it in one of God's most heartfelt missions, which is to have compassion for the poor, who really don't have enough to eat? You know, one of the most contemporary phrases used in hunger ministries is food insecurity. That just sounds like a terrible thing. That you sit at one meal with whatever little you have, knowing you ought to be worried about the next meal. And yet, God, there's this amazing invitation. And so you get to the book of Acts, and the Holy Spirit comes in power. And one of the things the power of the Holy Spirit does is it begins to build this community where they're sharing all things in common, and they're pooling their resources, and they're learning to be at help in one another's lives. And later on in the book, the testimony of the world is, look how they care for one another and love for one another. And one of the things that the power of the Holy Spirit does is it turns hearts from being insulated and turned inward to turned outward. And suddenly we really begin to become the salt of the earth. Salt preserves, right? It gives flavor. And all you have to do is to step into the world of poverty and to begin to be generous and to be present. Be present with your soul and be present with your resources. And you begin to understand what it's like to bring flavor into somebody's life who's in great need. It's almost like watching a wilted flower perk up with water and sunshine. And then there's light. And when we step into this place and we say, God, we would help you help your world in the power of your Spirit, using the resources you've placed in our hands. Just as we are, what we have, we'll be your helpers in this world. And I wonder what the Hebrew word is for God's people are my helper. God's people are my helper. Some of my generation, we liked the Beatles. And some of us in particular liked John Lennon. And then he sang that stupid song, Imagine. Imagine there's no heaven. Right? Imagine there's no religion. Imagine there's no possessions. What is this? A bunch of naked people in a vacuum? Imagine a kingdom where the Creator has created a world full of abundance. And when it broke, He committed Himself to sacrificing Himself to make the great repair. And in the great repair, He suddenly made it possible for all those in the broken world to begin to truly love and help one another. And there began to be this flow of resources for those who had to those who had not. And this wellspring of gratitude and joy. And people began to imagine to be connected deeply with one another. Okay, I'll give him John Lennon. Imagine no religion, but imagine the kingdom with Jesus. And a world gathered around the one who has come to repair and to recreate and to release an army of lovers and helpers who become salt and light. And the most amazing thing about the invitation, nobody needs be heroic. You just find the one place where you can share some of what you've got to make a difference in that life, in that place. And God is able to multiply what we bring Him. And wherever God's people step up, remember the parable of the story of the feeding of the 5,000? And there's a cry to 5,000 and Jesus stops everything and turns to the disciples and says, you feed them. Well, how are we going to do that? And then they find some resources, the five loaves and the two fish, and it's just what they have. And there's not a day where we can't bring what we have to the needs of the world and Jesus won't bless it and make a difference. I'd say in all the parables, if the only person who's the poor guy gets a name, that means pay attention. That God's heart is a heart for the poor in the world. And he says, part of what I want to mark my people is that you would learn to join me in stepping into those places, across those chasms. Just bring what you have, and I'll bless it, and I'll multiply it, and I'll make a difference. And if you don't do that, you'll remain a part of the problem, the chasm. But if you do that, great things will happen. And neighbor will connect with neighbor. And people will see the goodness of God and the generosity of God. And God's people will discover that He is a God of unlimited resources. And we'll discover that in the smallest of ways, when we give ourselves generously, He just makes it so much more than it could ever be. Imagine the kingdom as Jesus paints the picture, and that you and I are invited by name to come and learn to be one of God's helpers, dependent on Him, led by Him, counting on His resources, but it's our lives, our hands, and our feet. God did not send some strange miracle to Eastern Kentucky yesterday. He sent 6 people from apostles who sweated and gave of themselves and were God's helper in God's world. That's what He's calling us to. That's how the world becomes a better place. That's how the chasm gets bridged. That's how the change happens. The kingdom comes. And you shall receive power. Power to be God's helpers in God's world, led by His Spirit, with the resources He has placed in your hands and in your homes, that you might become, for the world, the help of God in a concrete way. Imagine, Jesus says. And the alternative remains danger, danger. Amen?